I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. About 100 years ago, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote that the human species so shade and mingle with each other that it's impossible to draw a color line between black and other races. More than a decade ago, the then head of the National Human Genome Research Institute said race was a flawed and weak concept. Our guests argue in a just-published paper in the journal Science that the biological concept of race in human genetic research is, quote, problematic at best and harmful at worst. They call on researchers to find a better way. Michael Udell, Dorothy Roberts, and Sarah Tishkoff are three of the four authors of this Science article titled Take Race Out of Human Genetics. And they join us on Radio Times to talk about the meanings of race and how it has been used and misused in the biological sciences. And let me introduce them to you. Dorothy Roberts, I'm going to do this once for you, Dorothy, is the George A. Weiss University Professor of Law and Sociology and the Raymond Pace and Sadie Tanner Moselle Alexander Professor of Civil Rights at the University of Pennsylvania. She also directs the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society. Her most recent book is called Fatal Invention: How Science, Politics, and Big Business Recreated Race in the 21st Century. And Dorothy Roberts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us is Sarah Tishkoff. She's an evolutionary geneticist. She's also the David and Lynn Silfen University Professor of Genetics and Biology at the University of Pennsylvania. Sarah Tishkoff, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. And to round out our trio of guests, we have Michael Udell, Associate Professor and Chair of Community Health and Prevention at the Dornsife School of Public Health. That's at Drexel University, wrote a book called Race Unmasked, Biology and Race in the 20th Century. And Michael Udell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
So where to begin? I have to say, I'm going to begin when I quoted W.E.B. Du Bois and I saw all three of you put your thumbs up. So this has been, Michael, a conversation that's been going on for 100 years, probably more, about how we think about race, it means.
Yeah, so the debate over the nature of race as a biological concept really dates back to Du Bois. Certainly as a point of resistance to the integration of ideas about race into biology and soon thereafter into genetics. But we could go back even further in U.S. history and look at Thomas Jefferson as not only a great political theorist, but a scientist who, between writing the Declaration of Independence and becoming the third president of the U.S., wrote a very important book called Notes on the State of Virginia, where he introduced a lot of ideas that were coming out of Europe about discrete racial differences, about very loose hereditary ideas about race, and then moving through the 19th century, we see those ideas evolve. It's at the beginning of the 20th century when genetics begins to rise as a field that we see the beginning of resistance to these ideas.
So how should we, Sarah Tishkoff, so how do you want us to think about what race is? I mean, we are live in a country where we talk about race a lot. Now, this is about biology and genetics, but how should we think about it?
So I think we should not be thinking about it in terms of race, or at least for certain purposes that we're going to talk about in terms of biomedical research, because there are no clear genetic boundaries, no clear ways to define race as we use race in the U.S. today. So, for example, we talk about Hispanic. Some people think of a Hispanic race. And that's a really good example, because if we look at genetic ancestry, people who may self-identify as Hispanic may have varying amounts of European or Native American or African ancestry. And the way that someone self-identifies in terms of their so-called race or their culture or their ancestry may be different than what the genetics looks like.
And so, I mean, self-identify is someone to say, this is who I am.
Exactly.
I mean, for whatever reason, this is who I am. You're saying dig a little deeper and that the genetics may prove them or say that they're wrong?
Well, and I also think that what terms we should use depends on the questions being asked. So I'm a human evolutionary geneticist. I study African genetic diversity. And typically, I will base many of my questions on languages, for example. I want to know what language people are speaking. I want to figure out the history and relationship of those people. Sometimes you'd want to know about ancestry. Sometimes you might want to know about culture. It really depends on the question that you're trying to address.
So is there, you mentioned Africa, so is there an African race?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
That is one of the most frustrating things I hear. So we've been, myself and my students and collaborators in Africa have been studying African genetic diversity for over 15 years. And one of the things that we've seen is there's more variation in Africa than any place in the world. We see more variation across different regions of Africa than we do almost on a global level. So you can't characterize any particular African population as being representative. I'll see more diversity in Eastern Africa compared to Western or Southern and Central and so on. So it's actually kind of ludicrous to even think of a single African race.
Well, can we think of a white race or an Asian? I mean, is it probably the same mixing and diversity?
That's exactly right. So there's no clear boundaries. And so, you know, we're not saying that there's no genetic diversity. Genetic diversity exists, absolutely. And it's simply a reflection of a number of things, including our evolutionary history, our demographic history. We know that modern humans arose in Africa about 200,000 years ago. We think that they left Africa about 50 to 100,000 years ago, small numbers, relatively small, hundreds or maybe thousands, and then gave rise to populations around the world. And every time they migrated to a new region, we call that a founder effect. Mm. And it somewhat shifts the frequency of different genetic variants. And then people adapt to different environments. But then, as a species, we really like to move around into, you know, we call it in genetics admix or intermarry. In fact, when we left Africa, we even admixed with Neanderthals and other archaic populations that were out there. So, you know, we don't discriminate, at least not in the past. And so that's been the history of humans, is a lot of admixture. There's no firm boundary. You'll see what we call clinal patterns of variation, mm-hmm. so shifts in frequency of variants as you move, say, west to east across Eurasia. But there's not – I can't say there's a clear boundary.
Well, Dorothy, let me get you in on the conversation and look at what we've been talking about through this perspective, I guess, of medicine and medical research. How do you see it?
Well, I'm a social scientist and a legal scholar. And I can confirm everything that Sarah said as a geneticist through the lens of social science. Race does exist, but we know that it has changed so drastically over the centuries and among different countries that it isn't a fixed biological category. It's clearly a social category. And we can even talk about the invention of race, that it was created by Europeans to justify slavery and colonialism. And the groupings that we talk about now, as Sarah said, there's no way to identify them biologically, but we can identify them socially based on the legal and social and cultural definitions. So one of the big problems with using race as a category in human genetics research is that it confuses a social category for a biological category. And that problem also then extends into medicine when doctors treat patients by race as if there are fixed biological distinctions between these groupings, when in fact there aren't. And the disparities that we see in health stem from social determinants, from social inequality. So I think one way of making this clear is to point out that race is not a natural division between human beings that creates health disparities because of genetic difference, mm-hmm. but it is a real social political category that results in biological consequences, but not because it's innate in people of different races, but because of racial inequality that produces different health outcomes for people of different races.
Let me throw something out there. I'm thinking of, let's say, something like, heart disease or,
yes.
or diabetes.
Yes.
The thinking, perhaps, is that you see more of that among African Americans. You're saying that's not race-based. It's because perhaps African Americans live a certain lifestyle or have certain experiences that could create those conditions.
Yes, there are a number of illnesses, diseases, where African Americans have a higher incidence of those illnesses, or also a higher death rate. But why is that? It's not because African Americans are predisposed to die from cancer at higher rates or predisposed to die from diabetes or cardiovascular disease. The much more plausible and established and proven reason is because of higher rates of exposure to certain environmental toxins. We can think of Flint, Michigan, what's happening to disproportionately black people there because of exposure to lead in the water. African Americans have been exposed at higher rates to lead for decades and decades in this country because of lack of access to high-quality health care, because of food deserts in poor neighborhoods, and importantly, because of the experience of racism. There's more and more research showing that the stress from experiencing racial discrimination has negative health consequences, and we haven't even begun to measure that. Let's look at that before we jump to a conclusion. It's because of some innate genetic difference between people of different races.
Sarah, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, so I agree with Dorothy that there's clearly an environmental component for disease risk. But I would also argue as a geneticist that there are genetic risk factors as well. And we know that they do differ amongst different ethnicities or ancestries. And we think that this is a reflection possibly of our evolutionary history or demographic history. So I'll just give one example, which is kidney disease is very prevalent in the African-American community in the U.S. And it turns out that people who have studied the genetic basis of this found a gene, the name of it's called APOL1, which is strongly associated with risk for kidney disease. And it turns out that these genetic variants that are associated with disease appear to give protection to the parasite that causes sleeping sickness. It's called trypanosome. And so they think it rose to high frequency in Africa because it was protective, but it may also cause risk for kidney disease, particularly in a different environment. Mm. So there could be genetic risk factors and then a shifted environment together with all the factors that Dorothy talked about. So I think it's a combination of both.
Michael?
Yeah, I wanted to take us back to W.E.B. Du Bois, who you started the discussion with. And in Du Bois's early work, first here in Philadelphia with the publication of the Philadelphia Negro, which he wrote at the end of the 19th century, and then with the publication in 1906 when he was down in Atlanta with the book The Health and Physique of the Negro American, Du Bois started to identify a lot of these issues that we're bringing out today. And he looked specifically at disparities in health outcomes, including both infectious and chronic diseases, and marshaling statistics from the Freedmen's Bureau, from the census, and from early anthropological work looking at race differences, came to a lot of the same conclusions that we're talking about at this table this morning. And here we are 100 years later having nearly an identical discussion about what race means, how we should understand human genetic diversity. And as a historian, you know, this was incredibly eye-opening and frustrating and, you know, just amazing that here we were. When I started writing my book, there was this moment when Craig Venter and Francis Collins and Bill Clinton stood at the White House and basically said in unison, there's no such thing as race in genetics. It's not a useful way to understand these differences.
And here we are.
And here we are.
I do want to pick up on a bunch of different things that were just said. Yes, we are talking about the various meanings of race, how it's been used and misused in biological sciences. And our guests are Michael Udell, Dorothy Roberts, and Sarah Tishkoff. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Just a recap here. Medical and genetic researchers often use the category of race in their work, but in a recent article in the journal Science, a group of local professors, three of whom are with us here in our studio, argue that race is not an accurate marker of our genes, and even more, using it is both imprecise and potentially dangerous. Dorothy Roberts, a professor of law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Sarah Tishkoff, professor of genetics and biology at the University of Pennsylvania as well. And Michael Udell is chair of community health and prevention at the Dornsife School of Public Health, and that's at Drexel University, all here in Philadelphia. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Michael, you mentioned this right before the break, which is, you know, we've known this for a century or more, and during the break we were all saying, well, why? You know, if we've known this, why, as maybe the research or medical community, or maybe just, you know, regular folks like myself, why are we stuck on these ideas about race that don't seem to compute?
Yeah, well, I think it's helpful to go back to Du Bois one more time, if that's okay, because sure. Du Bois makes this argument and really loses the argument. And he talks about at the beginning of the 20th century how the color line will be the most significant issue for America moving forward. He makes this argument at a time when eugenics and genetics are growing up around this idea of race. And it's really not until the 1930s when a Russian scientist who actually flees Russia and ends up living here in the U.S., his name was Theodosius Dobzhansky, and is really one of the most important evolutionary thinkers of the 20th century, reimagines race and tries to take racism out of the race concept. And Du Bois, for most of his career, stands by this idea of race and pushes back against those who, even in the 1940s, anthropologists like Ashley Montague and others who are saying, let's use ethnicity, let's use other concepts besides race. And he feels like, well, you know, this is an important concept. It's simply a methodological tool to organize human populations. It has no social meaning. Hmm. And it's not a perfect tool, but it's the best tool we have. But later in his career, he begins to see how the race concept is misused and abused. And he has public fights with colleagues, actually one here in Philadelphia, Carlton Kuhn, who was an anthropologist at Penn. And it results in Dobzhansky in the early 1960s pushing back and saying, you know what? The study of race has fallen into disarray in human races. He studied ladybug beetles and Drosophila and didn't have these same issues. But, you know, he calls for the field to develop new methods, and we make that same call echoing his call in our paper.
You mentioned eugenics, and I'm wondering, Dorothy, about just, again, the sort of misuse of some of these racial designations, the idea that if you are black or white or Asian, that you have these certain characteristics.
Absolutely. The whole concept of race from the very beginning was a hierarchy of humankind. It always falls into who's superior, who's inferior in terms of intelligence, in terms of beauty, in terms of civilization. And that is the reason why race was created. And it's impossible to separate race from a hierarchical notion of human beings. That's why I think it's so difficult to eliminate it, because even though Dobzhansky said, well, there's the scientific meaning of race that's separate from the social meaning of race, it never has been separate. It was invented for social purposes. And until we grapple with the political meaning of race and how it continues to structure our society, we're not going to be able to resolve this as just a purely scientific question. Yeah. We have to grapple with the connection between race and racism. And that's one of the reasons why we're calling for scientists to rethink their use of race as if it were a purely biological scientific concept, because it just isn't.
Well, let me pick up on that and put that to you, Sarah. So what are you asking your colleagues to do? And is it just to substitute a different word or to think differently about how we think about things like genes and ancestry and race?
So I think it's both, because language actually does matter. And when a scientist, when human geneticists use words like race or classify people into racial structures or classifications in the literature, that gives the wrong perception also to the general public. It sort of perpetuates this idea that there's some kind of a biological classification. So actually, language is important. Mm-hmm. And I think that's at least a start. We're calling, therefore, upon journals to actually make people justify use of these terminologies. And we're trying to encourage scientists to refer to whatever subjects you're studying or groups in the way that's most relevant to the questions being addressed. Typically, ancestry is going to be much more relevant. And in terms of, you know, we talked about having this whole discussion that's been going on for probably hundreds of years. But at the National Institutes of Health, for example, there have been a number of meetings convened between geneticists and sociologists and historians trying to address this question of use of race in medicine. And we always get stuck on the definition of race for exactly the reasons that Dorothy was talking about. These sort of biological and cultural definitions are intertwined. We can't separate them, and we can never come to any agreement. And that's one of the reasons that should be like, okay, let's just get rid of that then. But we never went forward. We never really moved beyond these discussions and debates. And so what we're calling for now is let's do something. Mm-hmm. Let's change policy. Let's move forward.
But you mentioned ancestry, and I'm assuming ancestry has more to do with, if not individuals, but group, you know, individuals who are related to each other, whereas race is this much broader designation or definition of groups of people that perhaps outwardly what look alike.
Right. That's true. But, you know, if we talk about outward looks, and people often, for example, think about skin color and classify races based on skin color, that's one of the worst classifications or criteria, because you see people who are dark skinned, not just in Africa, but you see them in anywhere along the equator. So Papua New Guinea, South India, and so on. It's an adaptation, we think, having to do with the amount of sun exposure.
Yeah, I think another difference is that ancestry traces an individual's actual genealogical past and the relationship between that individual and his or her ancestors and the what that means for genetics, human evolutionary biology, whatever health, whatever purpose we're looking at. Race begins with an a priori assumption about a group, and then it tries to fit individuals into that group. And as Sarah was saying, the test for who belongs to what race often doesn't make any sense. It's contradictory. There are ambiguous meanings that are used in science. It's actually, I find, as a social scientist, looking at the way that race has been used in biomedical research and even genomic research, extremely sloppy. Scientists don't define what they're talking about. What do they mean by race? Who belongs to each of these categories they're using? Often it's the census category that isn't even a biological category.
Well, I was thinking of that, about the forms that we fill out, Michael, and they ask, not all of them obviously, but ask, you know, what is your race? And you get a choice and you pick a box. So, and how would you know based on what you all are saying?
Well, we're talking about an approach that is much more complex than the current approach, but I would put out to the listeners to think about our president, who has an African father and a white mother. What race is President Obama? I mean, President Obama is clearly an African-American man based on American standards, based on the historical one-drop rule, which was a way to control blacks during slavery. But these ideas are much more complex. Right. So when President Obama goes to the doctor, if we're making racial assumptions, we're making an assumption based on only 50% of what the physician or he will identify as his race. But clearly his ancestry is much more complex. And that is, you know, a way to illustrate the point we're trying to make.
But it's also, and I guess just to complicate it further, as I understand it, I mean, he chooses to call himself a black man.
Yeah. So, you know, we are only talking about race in human genetics. We are not talking about social categories of race. You know, the lived experiences of peoples today and throughout history have been bounded by race. Race has been used as a tool of oppression for hundreds and hundreds of years in modern humanity. So we are in no way talking against race as a social concept. This is simply a genetic tool that we don't think is particularly useful. And because of the historical meanings and the social meanings of race, we would like to see scientists move beyond it.
Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody here. That's Michael Udell, also with us, Dorothy Roberts and Sarah Tishkoff. And again, there are three of four authors of an article that's gotten a lot of attention in Science titled Take Race Out of Human Genetics. And each of them working here in the Philadelphia area. Dorothy Roberts, professor of law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Sarah Tishkoff, professor of genetics and biology, also at the University of Pennsylvania. And Michael Udell, chair of community health and prevention at the Dornsife School of Public Health, and that's at Drexel University. 1-888-477-9499. An email from Bob. He says, sickle cell anemia is a result of inequality? Question mark, question mark, question mark. Dorothy?
I said,
we were
the first question is going to be on sickle cell anemia, because that's what everyone uses as if that proves that there is such a thing as the natural division of human beings into races. Sickle cell anemia is a trait that protects against malaria, and it's present in areas where there's a lot of malaria. It's not a black trait. All people identify as black, or even all people in Africa do not have sickle cell trait. It is simply an adaptation that happens to be more prevalent in certain parts of Africa. But as Sarah pointed out, Africa is extremely genetically diverse, and it doesn't, the fact that one trait is more prevalent in a particular group doesn't mean that it is associated strictly with an entire race. So that the argument about sickle cell confuses population, it confuses adaptation with the concept of race, which is much bigger than a particular population in a part of the world that may have an adaptation that is reflected in genetic prevalence.
Well, I'm thinking of Tay-Sachs. I mean, there are other diseases that we associate, perhaps wrongly, with certain, racial and ethnic groups.
Yeah, but this is about gene frequencies, right? This isn't about, the discrete or fixed differences between groups, right? So we do see higher frequency of sickle cell in certain African populations. We also see sickle cell in other parts of the world. We see it on the Arabian Peninsula. We see it on the Indian subcontinent, and we see it in some parts of the Mediterranean basin. So those are not African individuals. Those are individuals who have the same trait on other parts of the planet. Same for Tay-Sachs, same for other diseases.
You raised your hand, Sarah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, for example, someone goes to the doctor and they're suffering from anemia, and depending on how they self-identify, that doctor may diagnose or start doing tests for something completely different. So they could be self-identifying as white or of European descent. Maybe they've got the sickle cell trait. Maybe there's been some, ancestry from Africa in the past, or vice versa. And so they could be self-identifying as African American, and it turns out they have thalassemia because they have some ancestry from the Middle East or, things like that. So you want to – I think that knowledge of ancestry is absolutely useful, because you mentioned Tay-Sachs in Ashkenazi Jews. We know that there are certain diseases that are more prevalent in certain people of different ancestry, and that's important to know. But you want to avoid racial profiling where, you don't want to lump people into groups. You got to look at the individual. And in fact, that is sort of the goal of President Obama's precision medicine initiative, is ultimately he wants to see everybody characterized at the genome scale and do individualized treatments.
As opposed to saying you're white, you're African-American, so chances are your risk for X, Y, and Z is this. Let me read an email from George, who says, as a scientist, I find the level of political correctness here to be disturbing. I can't speak for George, but he's saying perhaps by sort of taking race out of it. Go ahead, Dorothy.
Who is being politically correct? We are arguing that scientists should have a more accurate, precise, scientifically valid, scientifically rational use of terms to define populations. How is that being politically correct? To me, it's being politically correct to hold on to race because of politics. It's because we live in a society where race is so entrenched in the way we think about human beings and the way their bodies operate, the way they act, what their opportunities are, that it's very hard to dislodge it even from studies of human genetic variation. As we've been talking about, there is so much evidence in history, in human biological research, in social science to show that race is not a natural division of human beings. And to me, it's because of politics that we're holding on to it. We're calling for a better, more scientifically accurate and defensible way of understanding human beings. I have to say, I am just so dismayed at how scientists would not want to take up our call to find a better way to study human genetic diversity. That's all we call for in our paper.
Sarah, anything you want to add to that?
Well, as a scientist, I could say that, no, I'm not simply trying to be PC. I'm actually trying to be correct.
That's a lot different.
Look at what we know that we cannot classify into at least what the U.S., Census Bureau or whatever would define as race in the U.S. It just simply cannot be done. It does not make sense in terms of genetic data. So let's get it right and forget about PC.
And have any of you had your genes you know, your ancestor, your gene? No.
No. No. I mean, I know my ancestry. I'm Ashkenazi Jewish. And I just feel like, I don't know. What else am I going to learn?
Oh, interesting. Yep. You wanted to add something, Michael.
Yeah, I would just go back to the caller's point and go back to, you know, that moment in the White House in 2000 when you had the two most important scientists on the planet from a genome perspective, that being Craig Venter and Francis Collins, echoing or anticipating what we're talking about here today. So it's not as if, you know, we're a bunch of yahoos sitting here making stuff up. You know, this is what we study. These are our fields. And, you know, we have the backing of not only of 100 years of scientists and social scientists making this argument, but really the most important people and knowledgeable people on the subject echoing what we're saying.
But is it, and we're almost up in a break here, but is it we just don't know how to talk about race anyway? I mean, I realize your paper is about something very specific about research in the scientific community and biology, but more broadly speaking, is we just fumble and fall over ourselves trying to talk coherently about race.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And if you look at the scientific literature, that incoherence is really ubiquitous. And there's this paradox that dates back to Dobzhansky's work, where scientists could say, on the one hand, race is simply a methodological tool to organize genetic diversity. But on the other hand, they would acknowledge it's an incredibly imprecise tool to understand that diversity. And that's where we've been stuck. And if you look at papers in major journals, you see that. People write about it openly. But why can't we move on it? And I think it goes back to the inseparability of social and scientific meanings of race and the difficulties of leaving this term behind.
And whether we just get hung up just by the way people look? I mean, just even
because
more
we're so used to identifying people by race. But even when one big problem is, how do you study race across different studies, across different countries, when scientists are using differing definitions? How can you compare studies if a scientist in Brazil means one thing, a scientist in the United States means another, one in South Africa means another thing? So even in terms of just the meaning of the term for scientific purposes, we need change.
And that's Dorothy Roberts, also with us, Sarah Tishkoff, and Michael Udell. We'll take a very short break. More comments and questions, I see. So do stay with us. We will be right back. Having an interesting conversation both on and off the air with our guest, Dorothy Roberts, professor of law and sociology, professor of civil rights at the University of Pennsylvania. She also directs the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society, and has written a book called Fatal Invention: How Science, Politics, and Big Business Recreate Race in the 21st Century. Sarah Tishkoff is an evolutionary geneticist, professor of genetics and biology, also at the University of Pennsylvania. And Michael Udell, associate professor, chair of community health and prevention at the Dornsife School of Public Health at Drexel University, author of Race Unmasked, Biology and Race in the 20th Century. You got a tweet call out there, Dorothy. Thank you, Dorothy, for the clearest explanation I've heard about sickle cell anemia. Hashtag racism, hashtag stereotypes, hashtag medicine. Also a tweet from Marlon. Excellent discussion on race, genetics, and history. Let me ask, just sort of picking up on perhaps where medicine is going, which is a more personalized medicine, which I'm assuming at some point we'll have our own personal genome, and then doctors can figure out what's wrong with us and then create medicines to fix us. Am I looking into the future correctly, Michael?
Yeah, and that's the goal. I think that I would echo points that we made earlier about not forgetting that health and medical outcomes are also about the environments in which we live. But I do think that that's the direction in which we're heading.
I would just say that we have a long ways to go.
Right.
So, right, in an ideal world, ultimately, if everybody could be sequenced, and we don't even have to worry about what people self-identify as or what a doctor labels someone as or thinks they are, and the goal would be based on our genomes to be able to figure out better treatments. And that's a great vision and a great goal, but we're far from that. So at this point, we don't really know the genes that are playing a major role in most of the common diseases like hypertension and diabetes, heart disease, and so on, because they're due to many, many different genes and environments. So we have a long ways to go, but that's sort of the long-term goal.
And I would add to that personalized medicine is not going to erase health inequities. So one of the big problems with treating race as a biological category in human genetics research and biomedical research is that it tends to divert attention from the social inequities that produce health disparities along racial lines. And those disparities, because they are so shaped by social inequality, it's not clear that personalized medicine is going to be able to erase them. In fact, we also have to be concerned about who is going to have access to personalized medicine. We already have a healthcare system with huge, huge disparities where people can't get access to basic medical care. So do we think that sometime soon, even if it's possible to set up the healthcare system to sequence people's individual genomes and then prescribe medication accordingly, that everyone is going to have access to this? It's very likely that the same inequities in access to care that exist today will continue to exist. And so that's another reason why I don't see personalized medicine as a panacea for ending health inequities in this country.
Anyone want to add to that?
Given that we're moving in this direction, I think our paper comes at an opportune moment to hopefully redirect the discussion away from racial categorizations.
Absolutely.
In biomedical research.
It's another reason why our call is so important, yeah. I think.
And
go ahead.
And what we've called for is that we're calling on the National Academies of Science to convene a working group, a multi-year panel to work with geneticists, to work with social scientists, to come to some consensus that we can make recommendations to the field about what terminology should we be using when studying human genetic diversity. How can we develop best practices within genetics to improve the study of human genetic diversity?
Let me read a couple more emails. One from Jill: how can we operationalize the dispensing of racial categories in science? And then a comment to chip away at racism. I mean, is there – you mentioned racial profiling. I mean, Sierra used that. Mm-hmm. I mean, does the kind of these racial categories and designations, is that racism or is it just shorthand that's not
– No, it's not always racism. And I would actually say that most of the geneticists I know of are of very good intent, and you know, most people are not assigning hierarchical categorization or anything like that. But often, particularly in medical genetics, in the clinical aspects of genetics, that's where we often particularly see racial classifications. So they'll talk about studies of Caucasians and Africans and whites and so on. And that can then lead to these misconceptions that there's some kind of a biologically concrete, you know, distinction. And so it perpetuates the problem. But that's where I tend to see it most often. And one thing I will mention is we did a study ourselves where we looked at people from Africa, looked at variants across the genome from Africans, from Europeans, and self-identified African Americans. And what we now can do with current technology, even if we don't sequence the whole genome, you can use markers around the genome, and you sort of slide along each chromosome. And at any particular region, you can say someone is of European ancestry in both chromosomes from mom and dad, African ancestry or mixed ancestry. And when we looked at people who self-identified as African American, first we saw a huge range of ancestry. So from people who had almost no African ancestry to the opposite end of the spectrum. But at any particular region in the genome, someone who self-identifies, for example, as African American could be 100% European at that particular region. So imagine that there is a gene there that plays a role in drug metabolism.
Right.
And someone could get it totally wrong if you're basing it, you know, on self-identified or perceived racial classification.
Did you want to add to that, Michael?
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on two points. One about the drug metabolism point. Craig Venter wrote a paper probably 6 or 7 years ago with his colleagues where he used his gene sequence, because his genome had been completely sequenced, and Jim Watson's gene sequence, and showed how despite both of them self-identifying as Caucasian, they had different drug metabolism genes for a particular gene variant. And his point was making those racial assumptions can often take us in the wrong direction and put patients at risk. The other point I want to pick up on that you and Sarah were talking about a moment ago is this idea of race and race profiling and the way these biological ideas about difference impact social ideas about difference. And we saw that 2 years ago with the publication of Nicholas Wade's book, A Troublesome Inheritance, in which he made several outlandish claims about the nature of race differences and how those related to human social behavior, forcing the geneticists whose work he was citing and misusing to issue a statement against that book and against that work. So we see the way in which scientific ideas can seep out into social conceptions and actually do some damage.
And I was actually one of those geneticists who signed
that. Oh, you were?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I mean, there have been some books written about IQ and intelligence and making, drawing assumptions.
Well, there's a long, long history going back to the slavery era. Michael mentioned Thomas Jefferson promoting some of these ideas, all of which were in the service of justifying enslaving African people for medical reasons. And then in the eugenics era, which either some say it ended with World War II, but there's evidence that even eugenics boards continue to operate in the United States into the 1970s. And we can still hear eugenicist ideas that social inequality is actually caused by biological difference. Mm-hmm. The bell curve published not too long
Charles
ago.
Murray.
Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein, and now Nicholas Wade's book. And we could cite many, many other books that continue to promote this idea that biological differences among races produces social differences in behavior, in intelligence, in violence. These ideas are very common still, too common still. And the biological concept of race in human genetics research, even if the researchers don't intend to do it, it helps to fuel these ideas about superiority and inferiority in social behavior as well.
Sarah, you want to add something? Then we'll get some callers in.
I was going to say that there was actually a group of economists who wrote a paper, and they took data from actually a study I was involved in where we looked at highly variable regions of the genome, looked at variation across the world, and they looked for correlations between the level of genetic diversity, and I think they were classifying somehow how economically robust, I guess, the population was, or, you know, and they came to the conclusion that having an intermediate level of diversity was best. And of course, that correlated with what we see in Europe simply due to our demographic and evolutionary history. And I was just shocked by this.
But that's what has happened from the very beginning when European typologists invented the notion of race and classified whites at the top and blacks at the bottom. We can see this with slave medicine, where people like Samuel Cartwright argued that slavery was beneficial to blacks for medical reasons because black people's lungs had lower capacity. And so they had to be forced to work in order to have good health. You know, I could go on and on and on with the justifications for inequality rooted in biological difference. And it just happens. It just happens that those who are in power and are able to get the attention and get published are the ones who see themselves as the superior ones.
Let me get some callers. And it looks like we have Mary from Warrington to join our conversation. Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I had just called because my son is of mixed heritage, and he has muscular dystrophy. And traditionally, people think of that as a strictly white disease. And he's light enough that sometimes people think he is white. And actually, my concern at this point isn't the racial disparity, but what happens to people who go in nursing homes and the government is paying for it and you don't have a doctor there every day. You know, the nurses call when there's a problem and that kind of thing. So, but my son, he thinks of himself as mixed parentage. He never says he's black or white. When right. Obama became president, he said, Obama's just like me. And that's how he looks at himself. As a matter of fact, he wanted me to decorate his room with St. Patrick's Day decorations. So
sounds like a real
very healthy.
Mary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and sounds like she's to some degree living what it is that we have been talking about. Let me get John from Westchester to join us. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Last spring, I went to a conference in Germany where they were talking about Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, who was a really early scientist studying race. And what came out of that was that he had written stuff in Latin that was very anti-racist, but then it was translated into English later on, and they inserted all kinds of racist stuff into it. And I'm just wondering if the folks there know of any other instances where you'd have these anti-racist scholars who are kind of in the minority, who then other people just misinterpreted everything so that it would fit the kind of the dominant racist ideas of the surrounding culture.
Michael, we're all looking at you for some reason. I'm not sure.
The historian.
So I know a little bit about Blumenbach, and I didn't know what you're describing. But I know that his work was used in a way that sort of moved along notions of these continental differences. Whether he imbued them with racist notions or others did, he essentially was one of the architects of the continental groupings of peoples around the planet.
This may be a little off target, but as we were pulling this show together yesterday, Debbie Builder and I, she gave me a couple of articles about Rachel Dolezal. And as we know, she was the head of the local chapter of the NAACP, who claimed that she was black, and it caused a whole, you know, stir because she didn't look black. What can I say? And Dartha, you're nodding your head. I mean, I realize your article is focused on research and genetics and the scientific community, but this stuff spills out.
Oh, absolutely, and spills in. So spills what's going on in our society affects the way in which researchers think about race as well. That whole incident of Rachel Dolezal did raise questions about the meaning of race and the meaning of self-identification, the fluidity of race. Was it all right for someone to identify as African-American or as black if they hadn't in the past? And so I think on the one hand, you could argue, well, race is a social construct. Why shouldn't it be all right for someone to identify as African-American if they want to? But it also raises questions about the meaning of the experience of being black in America. Right. And what many people objected to was that she had identified as white most of her life. She had gotten the privileges of being white, and now she was claiming to be a black person for her own advantage. And that was what troubled many people, that even though race is a social construct, it is a real category that really affects people's life chances and the way they're treated in this society, and you can't just make it up. It is a material category. It's real, but it's not real because human beings are naturally divided that way. Mm. It's real because it is a category of governing people, of determining people's life chances, and it affects their experiences, including their health, but including every other aspect of their lives as well.
How they're seen in the world. Well, we're almost out of time here. I mean, Sarah, do you feel after, what, a couple centuries of a discussion about race that the country or perhaps people in the scientific community are ready to take this next step that you all are suggesting?
Yeah, I think that they are. I think already the National Institutes of Health has expressed a very strong interest in what we're discussing, and I think we are ready to move forward because we also, the technology has gotten to a point where we're learning a lot more. So I think the timing's perfect.
Well, it's been a really interesting discussion. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Sarah Tishkoff, Dartha Roberts, and Michael Udell. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler, Susan Greenbaum helping us out this week. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.